The events of 1995, the Ulm attack, the Oklahoma City bombing, the Iraqi admissions, should have served as exclamation points in Danzig's campaign. But the message was not taking hold where it counted, in the federal budget. The number of people working at Fort Detrick, the nation's premier germ defense laboratory, had dropped about 30% since the Gulf War. At the Pentagon, Admiral Owens was targeting the budgets for chemical and biological defense for a $1 billion cut over 5 years, a reduction of nearly one-third. A new General Accounting Office report summarized the low standing of chemical and biological defense in the Pentagon. American soldiers, the auditors wrote, face many of the same problems they confronted during the Persian Gulf conflict in 1990 and 1991. Local commanders were using money designated for chemical and biological training to pay for operating expenses. Three of the Army's five divisions were missing half the required protective suits and other items critical for defense against a germ or chemical attack. U.S. forces continue to experience significant weaknesses in 1. Donning protective masks, 2. Deploying detection equipment, 3. Providing medical care, 4. Planning for evacuation of casualties, and 5. Including medical and biological issues in operational plans. The report blamed the military's senior officers, the joint chiefs, and the regional commanders around the world for failing to give the issue a high priority. Successful leadership in government agencies is about picking your battles, about knowing when to give up. Danzig had plenty of other issues to worry about as Undersecretary of the Navy. Still, he refused to accept defeat. If the Joint Chiefs did not see the need to inoculate the troops or build biodefenses, it was because the case had not been made effectively. Owens retired at the end of February. Danzig redoubled his efforts. The Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, chaired by Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, held one round of hearings on the Aum Shinrikyo attack in 1995. The image of the Tokyo emergency personnel choking in the sarin fumes continued to haunt Nunn and John Sopko, his investigator. The Georgia Democrat wanted to do something for domestic defenses against germ or chemical attack. Bill Richardson, the recently retired Pentagon expert who was advising the committee, told Sopko that a modest program, $35 million a year at most, could train emergency personnel in key cities. Sopko responded, "None's going to retire. We may never get another shot. Let's make it $100 million." The subcommittee focused on civil defense at its hearings, which opened on March 27, 1996. A staff report written by Sopko and his colleagues asserted that terrorist attacks with germs were all but inevitable. "The threat of a terrorist group using a nuclear, biological, or chemical weapon is real," the report said. "It is not a matter of if, but rather when." Senator Nunn, the New Mexican Republican Pete Domenici, and the Indiana Republican Richard Lugar closed ranks around a plan to train first responders in 120 cities. At the Pentagon, Richard Danzig began courting the vice chiefs, organizing a new round of seminars that took on the arguments against anthrax vaccinations one by one. To the oft-repeated view that nuclear weapons were a deterrent, Danzig responded that rogue nations could attack the United States through surrogate terrorist groups. American presidents were reluctant to order punishment unless they had undeniable proof of culpability. Intelligence officials, he reminded the vice chiefs, had argued for years over whether the 1989 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 could be linked to Libya, Iran, or Syria. Danzig brought in Josh Lederberg to address the scientific objections. Some of the vice chiefs had said anthrax vaccinations could be delayed because researchers would soon produce a single inoculation that would protect against multiple diseases. "Not so," Lederberg told them. "Such a vaccine was still years, if not decades, away. What of the view that genetic engineering rendered vaccinations useless?" Lederberg patiently explained why making superbugs that could survive outside a test tube was harder than commonly understood. "You'll have substantial gains if you inoculate," he assured the officers. In the spring of 1996, a serious obstacle to the plans for vaccinating the troops surfaced. Two teams of consultants who had visited the aging Michigan lab warned that it stood a substantial chance of flunking its next FDA inspection. The only other manufacturer of anthrax vaccine outside Russia was Britain's Porton Vaccines, which would need 6 months to gear up for producing 50,000 doses a week. The UK vaccine, made from a different anthrax strain than Michigan's, was not licensed for use in the United States. Without the Michigan lab, there would be no program of anthrax vaccination anytime soon. On June 21, 1996, the Pentagon made an announcement that shattered the military's credibility on medical issues and changed the politics of the debate on vaccinations. For nearly 5 years, military officials had insisted that no one serving in the Persian Gulf War had been exposed to chemical or biological weapons. Now they were forced to recant. Tens of thousands of Allied soldiers might have been exposed to nerve gas after American soldiers blew up an Iraqi ammunition depot containing chemical weapons. The detectors picked up no sign of a chemical release that day, but officials said the detection equipment appeared to have been faulty. There were reliable intelligence reports dating from 1991 that said the Iraqis had stored chemical weapons at the depot. But the Pentagon said the information had been overlooked for years through a series of bureaucratic mishaps. Veterans suffering from Persian Gulf symptoms were stunned. The military, they felt, had lied to them about the cause of their illnesses, just as it had lied to previous generations of soldiers about the effects of radiation and of Agent Orange. A team of government experts pored over the records and discovered a second incident in which Allied soldiers had blown up chemical weapons, deepening the veterans' suspicions. The internet buzzed with theories of cover-up. On June 25th, 4 days after the Pentagon's first disclosures, Islamic militants in Saudi Arabia detonated a truck bomb near an apartment building that housed hundreds of American servicemen. The attack on Khobar Towers killed 19 and wounded as many as 500. To Danzig and his colleagues, it added another powerful argument in favor of improving what the military calls force protection. The Pentagon's experts did some calculations. If the truck had been packed with chemicals or germs, the effect on the troops in Saudi Arabia would have changed from tragic to apocalyptic. The soldiers at Khobar Towers were not prepared for attack. None had their gas masks at hand when the bomb went off. Danzig and Joseph pressed their case for a relatively modest program that would implement Defense Secretary Perry's 1993 directive. Vaccinations for those servicemen in high-threat areas or assigned to early deploying units. But the commanders did not see how they could operate with a force that was only partially protected. If the assumption was that germ weapons would be used against rear areas, one would also need to inoculate the National Guardsmen who worked in support positions. A turning point in Danzig's meetings with the vice chiefs came when General Richard Hearne, the vice commandant of the Marine Corps, declared that anthrax vaccinations should be given in boot camp, along with the other routine inoculations administered to new soldiers. Danzig had wanted to begin modestly, vaccinating the early deploying forces and those in high-threat regions like the Middle East. But the consensus had swung. If inoculations were needed, the officers concluded, they should be given to everybody. Hearne said Lederberg drove home the case for vaccinating before hostilities begin. People would argue, we don't want to do it, and insist that the vaccination should instead be given on the battlefield, said Hearne. I didn't want to take that chance. Danzig had an ally in General Dennis J. Reimer, the Army's chief of staff. Reimer had served in the Pentagon during the Gulf War and had directed the effort to improvise biological detectors. He was part of the debate over how to allocate the scarce vaccine supplies, an experience that framed his thinking on biological defense. You can't play God on this, Reimer said later. You've got to find a solution, and the only solution is to vaccinate everybody. The Army Vice Chief, Ronald Griffith, continued to question the policy. He had heard from colleagues in the Army that the Michigan facility was in trouble with the FDA and might not be able to make enough vaccine. That issue did not make much of a dent. It was assumed that the problems were technical. They could be overcome. By the fall of 1996, the chiefs had turned around and endorsed the recommendation to vaccinate the entire force. Owen's recommendation to cut $1 billion from the biological and chemical defense budget had been reversed as well, transformed into a $1 billion increase over 5 years. That decision, a $2 billion shift from January, reflected a radical change in priorities. Taking charge. The proposal to vaccinate the entire U.S. military against anthrax came before John P. White, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, in January 1997. An economist whose son had been a platoon leader in the Gulf War, White took the recommendation seriously. He respected Danzig, and it was not every day that the chiefs and the Pentagon civilian officials could unanimously agree on such a contentious issue. But White thought that the proposal to improve the military's biodefenses was spectacularly ill-timed. The uproar over Gulf War syndrome was escalating. Congress was holding hearings. First Lady Hillary Clinton was pressing the Pentagon to do more for the veterans. This was no time to be proposing new vaccinations. It was politically tone-deaf. "Are you guys out of your minds?" White asked the Pentagon's health experts. The program, they told him, was a straightforward effort to protect the force, insurance against a clear threat. White was unmoved. Ordering 2.4 million people to take 6 injections in the arm was far more intrusive than issuing soldiers a new type of flak jacket or helmet. White thought the immunizations should be deferred. Several years might be a good start. He ordered a new review of the vaccine's safety and efficacy. He also asked for a detailed briefing on how, precisely, the military planned to persuade servicemen to accept the program. At about this time, President Clinton named William S. Cohen, the Republican senator, to replace Bill Perry as defense secretary. Cohen had taken a keen interest in Aum Shinrikyo during the 1995 hearings. He had served as vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he came to his new job already persuaded that more should be done about the threat of biological weapons. The program to vaccinate American troops was proceeding with some difficulties. The most significant occurred on March 11, 1997, when the FDA warned the Michigan lab it could lose its federal license if it did not immediately make improvements. "The problems," the inspectors wrote, "represent a failure to comply with the regulations that safeguard the drug and pharmaceutical industry." Pentagon officials worried that the lab might not survive. Michigan's legislature had voted the previous year to sell the facility, and many key production officials were taking early retirement. The Pentagon sent an assistant assessment team to study the Michigan plant. The name summed up its conflicting missions. The Pentagon team concluded that the laboratory has shown significant improvements and could meet FDA standards if it was renovated as planned. The Joint Program Office, which was set up to manage biological defense, assured Cohen that the Michigan lab would be producing new vaccine within about a year. In the meantime, there was more than enough stockpile to begin the shots. General Anthony Zinni, the American commander for the Persian Gulf region, had told the Pentagon that his troops in Kuwait needed the immunizations immediately. If military action was ordered against Iraq, Zinni did not want to face the same vulnerabilities that had frustrated Schwarzkopf. The revelations about Iraq's program, which accelerated 2 years earlier with the defection of Hussein Kamel, had seeped through the American government. No one doubted Baghdad's ability to turn germs into weapons. After nearly 3 years of debate, the program had solid support from both civilians and military officers. Senior Pentagon officials understood they might have some difficulty selling the program to the troops. John J. Hamre, the Pentagon comptroller, told Cohen that the defense secretary, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and others in visible positions would have to be among the first to roll up their sleeves and take the shots. Cohen agreed. The Pentagon civilian leaders also worried about whether the military was able to manage a complex vaccine program that would involve more than 14 million shots. The failings in the Gulf War were now abundantly clear. The immunization records were a shambles. In addition, field commanders had repeatedly violated the Pentagon's agreement with the FDA, giving soldiers experimental drugs without informing them of the risks. The Cohen team vowed the anthrax program would be better run. It had been a tough day even by Pentagon standards. Pamela Berkowski, Cohen's special assistant and other top aides, spent most of Saturday, November 15, 1997, preparing for the defense secretary's appearance the next morning on the ABC News show This Week. The Clinton administration was girding for a new confrontation with Iraq. After admitting that he had lied about his germ programs, Saddam Hussein had refused to permit United Nations inspectors back into his country. Cohen's immediate goal that weekend was to build public support for the administration's plans to bomb Iraq if Baghdad did not relent. He also wanted to prepare the public for the anthrax vaccinations, which he planned to announce shortly. In their conversations that Saturday, Cohen's aides were searching for a way to dramatize the biological threat. Berkowski and her colleagues debated how Cohen could best translate the potential threat, the kill ratios of germ warfare, into terms that civilians could understand. Exposure to no more than 10,000 anthrax germs, all of which would fit comfortably into the period at the end of this sentence, could kill a human being. The group decided that Secretary Cohen should hold up a bag of flour and give an estimate of how many people would die if an equivalent amount of dried anthrax bacillus were spread over a city. At home that night, Berkowski told her husband, a surgeon, about the choice of visual aids. "Why not a bag of sugar?" he said. Not everyone used flour, but everyone was familiar with the heft of a 5-pound bag of sugar. The paper sacks were so familiar that he usually instructed post-surgical patients to lift nothing heavier. On Sunday morning, Bill Cohen unveiled his simulated weapon of mass destruction, a 5-pound bag of sugar. "Anthrax," he said, stunning the normally loquacious Sam Donaldson and Cokie Roberts into momentary silence. "If Saddam Hussein spread this amount of anthrax over a city the size of, say, Washington, D.C., it would destroy at least half the population of that city." "One breath," he continued, "and you are likely to face death within 5 days." Still worse was VX, a potent nerve agent that Iraq had also developed. If properly dispersed through aerosols, VX could kill millions, he said. Cohen reminded viewers that Iraq had initially denied making both nerve gas and germ weapons. In fact, he said, Iraq had made 4 tons of VX and at least 2,100 gallons of anthrax. Hoisting his bag of sugar even higher, he repeated the number. Roberts, tired of being upstaged by a bag of sugar, interrupted to ask, "Would the secretary please put that bag of sugar down?" Thus began the great sugar debate. Some military experts and scientists were outraged by Cohen's performance. Yes, a 5-pound bag of anthrax bacillus spores could theoretically kill half of Washington's population, or about 300,000 people. But only if the atmospheric conditions for such an attack were perfect, the germs very potent, and the dispersal highly efficient. If an attack occurred during a rainstorm or at midday in hot, sunny August, the germs might not harm anyone. Some experts privately grumbled that Cohen had presented a worst-case casualty estimate to terrify Americans. Although Bill Patrick said he regretted Cohen's inaccurate estimate of the casualties, he approved of the presentation. The secretary might have overstated the lethality of anthrax, but he had publicized a threat that had been largely ignored. Perhaps the sugar bag was melodramatic. Perhaps Cohen should have made it clearer that American intelligence analysts viewed Saddam Hussein as highly unlikely to attack either an American city or the 17,000 troops still stationed in the Persian Gulf. But Patrick felt that the right points had been made. Finally, someone in the political leadership had said out loud what he, Josh Lederberg, and others had been saying for years in secret government sessions. In late November 1997, culminating a drive that began after the Gulf War, the Pentagon awarded a $322 million 10-year contract to Dynport, a British-American venture, to develop and obtain licenses for smallpox and 17 other vaccines for the military, including a new recombinant version of the one for anthrax. The plan focused on building up a stockpile of advanced vaccines for the next century. On December 15th, the Pentagon announced that it would vaccinate the military against anthrax with the old vaccine, an unprecedented step to counter the threat of germ weapons. "We owe it to our people to move ahead with this immunization plan," Cohen said in a written statement. In 1995, Andy Weber was a young diplomat who was first secretary at the American Embassy in Kazakhstan, a newly independent republic that had broken away from Moscow in 1991. Weber was one of the first Americans to grasp the full extent of the Soviet biological weapons program. In June 1995, he led the first American mission to Stepnogorsk, the most advanced Soviet germ warfare production plant and the only one outside the Russian heartland. The scientific, experimental, and production base, as Stepnogorsk was formerly known, was built in 1982 to develop and manufacture a new, more lethal variant of anthrax. The factory offered Washington its first look at the inner workings of the Soviet Union's germ empire. Pasechnik and Alabek had already described the Soviets' vast germ warfare empire to Western intelligence analysts. Stepnogorsk was an integral part of Biopreparat, the laboratories and plants that supposedly manufactured vaccines and other civilian pharmaceutical products. Known to the Soviets as the Concern, Biopreparat was in fact a hub of Moscow's germ effort, a vast network of secret cities, production plants, and centers that studied and perfected germs as weapons. This vast Soviet infrastructure had been created in 1973, when the ink on the treaty banning germ weapons was barely dry. At its peak in the late 1980s, Biopreparat employed more than 30,000 people, about half of the 60,000 Soviets engaged in biowarfare, at more than 100 facilities throughout the Soviet Union. Secretly run by the military with an annual budget of close to $1 billion, the biological weapons program had stockpiled plague, smallpox, anthrax, and other agents for the intercontinental ballistic missiles and bombers aimed at New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Chicago, Seattle, and other American cities. The Concern had studied some 80 agents and prepared a dozen or more for war. Almost every Soviet ministry, from the Ministry of Agriculture to the Ministry of Health, and including even the notorious secret police, had contributed to the germ warfare program. The United States may have had a military-industrial complex, but the Soviet Union was a military-industrial complex. Standing inside Building 221, the main production site, Weber stared at the 10 20-ton fermentation vats that towered four stories above him like a row of Midwestern grain silos. Each vessel could hold 20,000 liters of fluid. Together, they filled a building 2 football fields long. Weber was given to understatement, but for him, the only word to describe what he was seeing was evil, pure evil. And the United States was doing virtually nothing about it. When he returned to Almaty, the Kazakh capital, Weber briefed Ashton B. Carter, an assistant defense secretary who was touring the region. The two men agreed that Weber's mission had created a unique opportunity. If the Clinton administration could help Kazakhstan salvage and convert its facilities, especially the complex at Stepnogorsk, it might prevent the scientists there from returning to germ warfare work and discourage the sale of their expertise to rogue states or terrorists. It could also create a precedent. A flourishing, prosperous Stepnogorsk would be a showcase to other former Soviet republics and even to Russia, which strongly resisted biological cooperation with the West. America, Weber urged Carter, had to make Stepnogorsk a poster child for the benefits of transparency, international cooperation, and non-proliferation. Not everyone in Washington shared the men's point of view. After the Soviet Union's collapse, Biopreparat had supposedly been reborn as a civilian drug company, 51% of which was owned by the Russian government. But its operations were still shrouded in secrecy, and it was still led by the same men who headed the program during the Cold War. Weber and the American analysts had to work intensively to piece together solid, accurate information about the scale, scope, and state of technological advancement of the former Soviet germ program. While the defectors Pasechnik in 1989 and Alabek in 1992 had given the West a detailed outline of Soviet germ activities, even they knew little about some areas and institutes. The program had been a deliberate maze of false fronts, secret projects, and parallel organizations that often conducted both military and peaceful research. The structure was designed to enhance secrecy. Weber could not afford to contemplate such obstacles. There was so much to be done. For instance, several former Soviet institutes in Kazakhstan that had been dedicated to developing germs to destroy plants and animals could not afford even rudimentary protection, electrified fences, guards, locks, and computerized access for their hundreds of strains of highly virulent pathogens. At the Anti-Plague Institute in Almaty, Weber had just visited a collection of more than 1,000 lethal germ strains that was protected only by a rickety wooden door and a single skeleton key lock. Asked if he would like to see a sample of the Institute's plague, Weber found himself holding a rusty pea can containing enough plague to depopulate the entire region. In July 1997, in Washington, D.C., Weber met Lev Sundakchiev, Vector's energetic director, who had surprised Josh Lederberg back in 1993 by calling for greater disclosure of the Soviet germ warfare program. Weber was aware that Sundakchiev, known for his fierce devotion to his staff, had privately been promoting the conversion of Vector into an open international center for research into viral vaccines and defenses against the spread of emerging infectious diseases. Weber was intrigued. Could America do business with this small but formidable man? American hardliners despised Sundakchiev. A member of the Russian team that had accused the United States of continuing its germ weapons program after visiting American drug companies and government labs in late 1991, Sundakchiev had joined his comrade Alabek in signing a report assailing the Americans. Nonetheless, Washington was growing more alarmed each day about intelligence reports indicating that Iran and other countries were targeting Vector's scientists in its relentless hunt for germ weapons expertise and deadly microbes. As Sundakchiev described it, life was bleak in Koltsovo, the small Siberian town near his giant, still-secret complex. Deprived of most Russian government funds since the Soviet Union's collapse, Vector was struggling to pay its scientists and technicians, less than half the number at the lab during its heyday. Many of its installations were now empty, unfinished, or deteriorating. While some Americans were gleeful about Vector's desperation, Weber knew that the Institute was vulnerable to offers of assistance from North Korea, Iraq, and especially Iran. Sundakchiev, whose forebears came from Armenia, feared the implications of the spread of Islamic militancy for his beloved Russia. By the year 2015, he said, Russia would be 60% Muslim. The insurgency in Chechnya was a harbinger, he feared. Russia, he conceded, had moved smallpox strains from the designated repository in Moscow to his remote Siberian complex without notice, violating World Health Organization rules. But the aim was not to do secret research, he told Weber, but to protect the strains against specific terrorist threats from Chechnya. Would the Americans like to see Amir Khatab, the ruthless militant Arab hero of the Chechen insurgency, acquire smallpox samples? Vector provided a more secure site for Russia's 120 smallpox isolates, the world's largest collection twice the size of America's, as well as its bank of some 10,000 isolates of the world's most exotic viruses and strains of other lethal pathogens, Marburg, Ebola, Lassa fever, and a variety of encephalitis strains. Just as Sendakchiev knew every strain in his collection, he also knew the location of every senior scientist who had left his institute, he said. There had been no thefts of dangerous agents from Vector, and none of his senior people had gone to work for Tehran. Yet. Weber, encouraged by his conversation with Sendakchiev, went to see his boss, Frank Miller, the acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy. Miller, a longtime champion of the Small Threat Reduction Program and a seasoned bureaucrat, liked Weber's proposal for how to open up Russia's closed military labs. He approved of Weber's suggestion that the U.S. Army's Surgeon General invite his Russian counterpart to visit American facilities as part of an exchange. In addition, Weber wanted money to help Sendakchiev open Vector to the world and deflect Iranian overtures. How much money would it take? Miller asked. About $3 million, Weber replied. Miller looked up quizzically over his wire-rimmed glasses. Was that all? He asked his protege. In Pentagon dollars, that was chump change. But getting authority to spend even chump change was complicated, especially since the intelligence agencies believed and had persuaded Congress that military-related germ research was still being conducted at Vector. He would get the money, Miller told Weber, but it would take time. Weber knew that Vector was running out of time. Scientists had to be paid. Something had to be done. In September 1997, Andy Weber and Ann Harrington, his State Department counterpart and a key ally, stared anxiously at the email letter they had written to Sendakchiev on her computer. They shared his frustration, Weber and Harrington wrote, with the pace of U.S.-Russian exchanges and the scope of assistance to Vector. Could a U.S. team visit Vector to tour the facility and discuss expanded, accelerated cooperation? No one had authorized such a letter, never mind a visit to Vector or a significant increase in foreign aid for it. Normally, such initiatives required weeks of bureaucratic clearances and endless red tape. Weber and Harrington knew they were taking a risk, but Weber was desperate to stop the departures of Russian scientists. And Harrington, an energetic woman who had become obsessed with Russia while living in Moscow as a diplomat's wife in the early 1990s, was equally committed to overcoming the bureaucracy's lethargic response to what she also considered a pressing threat. "Should I push the send button, Andy?" she asked nervously. "What can we lose?" Not much, Weber thought. If worse came to worst, he could always get a job assigning parking slots at the Pentagon, and Anne might enjoy stamping visas in the consular section of some obscure embassy in Africa. Who needed this aggravation anyway? The President. In late December 1997, President Clinton traveled to the resort island of Hilton Head, South Carolina, for the Renaissance Weekend, an invitation-only gathering of officials and private citizens who liked to ring in the new year with readings from Kierkegaard and half-day seminars devoted to such topics as moral compasses for modern leaders. One night, Clinton arranged to have dinner with J. Craig Venter, a molecular biologist who was pioneering the effort to map the genes of germs and people. The dinner party included only four couples, and Clinton and Venter spent much of the evening locked in conversation. Their talk turned to what the strides in genetic mapping would mean for germ warfare, an issue on which Venter had strong views. As head of the Maryland-based Institute for Genomic Research, a nonprofit group that deciphered microbes, he had recently helped map the smallpox virus. Venter warned Clinton that such work could be extraordinarily dangerous in the wrong hands, allowing a foe to reconstruct the rare microscopic killer. Most of the discussion was about smallpox and synthetic microorganisms and how to come up with effective defenses, Venter recalled. The president was extremely knowledgeable already. He said throughout history, the biggest changes have come when there were new offensive weapons without defensive ones, and he was worried that we were entering such a period. Clinton asked if smallpox could be spliced with another bug to make it more harmful. Venter replied that it could, and that a new novel, The Cobra Event, written by Richard Preston, author of The Hot Zone, presented just such a scenario. He urged the president to read it. Venter described smallpox as more dangerous than anthrax, even in its unaltered state. It was contagious wildfire, he told the president, a killer that leapt from person to person. By contrast, anthrax was incommunicable. It killed only where sprayed. Offering quick reassurance, Venter told Clinton that the gene mapping done at such places as his institute offered a new way to strengthen the nation's germ defenses. It could help create innovative cures and identify pathogens used in an attack by revealing their genetic signatures. The next day, Clinton sent an assistant to see Venter. The aide said the president would be grateful if the biologist would prepare a list of experts who could advise him on the topics they had discussed. Venter was delighted. In the months that followed, he talked repeatedly with the White House about possible candidates for the panel. Clinton had long been fascinated by the promise and peril of the new biology. His concern arose in part from the collapse of the Soviet Union, which had put tens of thousands of scientists privy to the technological secrets of mass destruction on the job market. The threat, Clinton would tell his aides, was obvious. He had also come to see the danger of germ weapons in the context of terrorist incidents that had marked his presidency. The attacks on the World Trade Center and the Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City had been done with simple fertilizer bombs, the subway gassings in Tokyo with home-brewed sarin. Clinton saw germs as the next logical step for terrorists. The president started inserting warnings in all his speeches, said Dick Clark, the National Security Council advisor on counterterrorism. Even if the subject was not relevant, he would start talking about bioterrorism as the dark side of globalization. Again and again, he would say, what if the World Trade Center and Oklahoma City had been a biological or chemical event? Clinton was a hands-on editor of his own speeches, and Clark said the germ references were his idea. At first we thought, well, this will pass. The president is interested in lots of things, Clark said. But it didn't pass. He kept after us. He wouldn't let it go. It wasn't just a whim. He was obsessed with it. Clinton's fascination with germ weapons was deepened by his reading. He devoured histories, newspaper and magazine articles, and especially fiction. Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six, a thriller about a counter-terrorist team's efforts to prevent Armageddon, made a big impression. Another favorite was a Patricia Cornwell novel that focused on a female medical examiner's battle against a shadowy figure intent on using mutant smallpox for mass murder. But nothing caught the president's attention as much as The Cobra Event, the novel Venter had recommended and that Clinton read in early 1998. It depicted a mad scientist's determination to thin the world's population by infecting New York City with a designer pathogen. By combining smallpox, a virus similar to that of the common cold, and an insect virus that destroys nerves, the scientist invented an ideal doomsday germ, a brain pox that spread quickly and melted the brain. Clinton was impressed by the book's grim narrative and apparent authenticity. Preston's acknowledgments included more than 100 experts, military officers, intelligence analysts, doctors, scientists, and officials in Clinton's own administration, including Danzig. The novel's science, Preston wrote in a preface, is real or based on what is possible. Clinton began asking his friends, cabinet members, even House Speaker Newt Gingrich whether they had read the book and what they thought about it. After a White House meeting on another topic, the president suddenly turned to John Hamray, now serving as the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and asked whether he could speak to him privately for a few moments. As the two men walked into the Oval Office, Clinton said he had recently read The Cobra Event and asked Hamray whether he thought the novel's scenario was plausible. Could a terrorist unleash an unstoppable plague with designer pathogens? Hamray was somewhat taken aback. He had not read the book and was no expert on superbugs or recombinant technology, he told the president. But I'll have 100 colonels reading the book at dawn, he promised. Returning to the Pentagon, Hamray searched in vain for the book. He finally borrowed the only one he could find, a copy from Secretary Cohen's private library. The next day, Hamray delivered a preliminary assessment to the White House. While the novel was not based on secret government data and contained no classified information, the scenario was theoretically plausible. In February 1998, the arcane intelligence debates about Russia's biological program exploded into public view. Ken Allebeck emerged from anonymity to charge publicly what he had said in secret government debriefings. The Russians were still making sophisticated bioweapons under the guise of developing vaccines for defense. In interviews with the New York Times and ABC's Primetime Live, Allebeck said that the Soviet Union's plans for World War III had included hundreds of tons of anthrax bacteria and scores of tons of smallpox and plague viruses. And he repeated in public his controversial charge that the Soviet labs had made hybrid designer germs from Ebola and smallpox that were impervious to vaccines and antibiotics. As Allebeck stunned legislators on Capitol Hill who had not known of the defector's existence, Andy Weber was making real progress in Russia. The gamble that Weber and his State Department colleague Ann Harrington had taken the previous September had paid off. Less than 24 hours after receiving the email they had sent him, Lev Sendakchev, Vector's director, had invited the Americans to visit his Siberian Institute. American experts were eventually permitted to tour Building 6, which housed the well-guarded smallpox laboratory, the huge aerosol test chamber, and the high containment labs where research on the other exotic agents was being conducted. They spoke at length to Vector scientists about their work and saw a video describing a controversial Vector expedition to a remote Siberian village. There, scientists had unearthed the long-frozen bodies of turn-of-the-century smallpox victims and taken samples from them. American teams visited new projects where the scientists who had once turned viruses into weapons were struggling to produce such commercial products as yogurt and a new line of cosmetics. And they were told that American researchers would soon be invited to spend weeks, even months, at Vector, working on joint projects with their Russian counterparts. Now, on a bitterly cold February day, Weber emerged from touring Building 6 and 6A, two adjacent four-story brick buildings where the Soviets had done some of their most sensitive work on Marburg and other deadly viruses. The U.S. effort to engage the Russians was working. The American team had visited every part of the compound that intelligence analysts had previously identified as suspicious, and they were now convinced that Vector was no longer engaged in offensive germ research and development. Equally important, the American team and Sendakchev had quietly struck an agreement restricting Vector's contacts with Iran for at least a year. The so-called gentleman's agreement, negotiated by a tau-clad Vector scientist and U.S. officials in the Institute's banya, or sauna, prescribed cooperation that had military uses with Tehran. While Vector could sell pharmaceutical products to Iranian companies, Sendakchev agreed not to exchange scientific visits, engage in collaborative research, or provide Iran with Russian research and development expertise and technology. The agreement was unprecedented. It was repeated in subsequent verbal compacts with other leading cash-strapped germ institutes, including the one at Obolensk, whose collection of several thousand bacterial pathogens had long worried Western analysts. General Nikolai N. Yurakov, Obolensk's long-serving director, pledged not only to forego commercial and scientific contacts with Iran, but also to lift what he called the curtain of secrecy that enshrouded the 25-year-old complex and spurred doubts about its supposed conversion from military to peaceful research. Not everyone shared Weber's enthusiasm for what administration officials were calling the Vector model. Four Russian military facilities were still off limits to American inspectors, and there was no way to ensure that American money and biotechnological expertise were not being shared with Russian germ warriors at these closed labs to make new generations of deadlier germ weapons. Weber and his colleagues were well-intentioned fools, a former intelligence officer complained. The Russians were taking the American handouts and laughing all the way to their secret labs. Given what he was learning about the former Soviet program, Weber couldn't discount such concerns. The breadth and depth of the program were shocking, even to supporters of the new cooperative effort. Just as Alabek had asserted, almost every Soviet ministry and important institution had played some role in the top-secret program. The Ministry of Defense, the Ministries of Agriculture, Health, and Science, the Communist Party Central Committee, and even the eminent National Academy of Science. The Ministry of Internal Affairs had provided prison labor to build the vast biowarfare complexes, as well as additional guards to supplement the military in protecting them. The Ministry of External Trade had secretly helped purchase equipment and animals for experiments. A special office in the Soviet Ministry of Justice had provided legal services and special courts for the Weapons Institute's personnel. The KGB had its own germ centers for developing methods of assassination. The murkiest parts of the Soviet effort were two closely related programs that were aimed at using genetically engineered germs and toxins to cause psychological and physiological changes. The first, called Bonfire, was overseen by a part of Biopreparat that even Alabek knew little about. That program had apparently created a new toxic weapon that manipulates peptides, the short chains of amino acids that send signals to the central nervous system. Such weapons could, in theory, alter moods, sleep patterns, and heart rhythms, all without detection. They could even kill, which explained why the KGB was particularly interested in them. The second program, whose code name was FLATA, which translates to flute, was run by the Ministry of Health's Third Directorate. Its main goal was to create psychotropic and neurotropic germ agents for the KGB, again using peptides and other bioregulators. Another focus of concern was the Research Center of Molecular Diagnostics and Therapy, which would soon start work on enzymes and vaccines to combat a variety of diseases, thanks to International Science and Technology Center grants, largely from the United States. During the Cold War, the Institute had developed psychotropic agents and peptides to alter mood and behavior as part of the flute program. The Institute was in the heart of downtown Moscow, near a hospital for alcoholics, drug addicts, and other social misfits. American officials had been told by what they called an impeccable source that the facility had tested its peptides and mood-altering agents on the patients confined to the hospital next to the lab. Though its director and staff vehemently denied the allegations, other Russian scientists insisted that the lab and other institutes as well had violated a profound moral taboo, the ban on human experimentation. Russian officials had adamantly denied the charge, which had been raised before, but Americans felt certain their sources were in a position to know about the testing. American officials were unable to learn more about the fate of the patients who had allegedly been subjected to flute testing. Few Russian scientists knew which particular peptides or agents had been given to patients or how many such experiments had been conducted. No Russian official would confirm, even in private, that such experimentation had occurred. In March 1998, more than 40 senior members of the Clinton administration gathered at Blair House to rehearse how they might handle a biological attack by terrorists. It was what the government calls a tabletop exercise. Dick Clark, the National Security Council advisor on counterterrorism, had convened the officials to give them a hands-on sense of the decisions they might face as an infection rocketed through a panicked population. The results of the drill were not encouraging. Local medical offices rapidly exhausted their stocks of antibiotics and vaccines. Federal quarantine laws turned out to be too antiquated to deal with the rapidly spreading epidemic, and no state had adequate plans to take care of the people it had isolated. Officials did not know where to store and bury the still contaminated dead. What began as a domestic disaster became an international crisis as the epidemic threatened to spread into Mexico. Discovering huge gaps in logistics, legal authority, and medical care, officials began quarreling among themselves and with Washington over how to stem the epidemic. No one seemed to be in charge. The hush of defeat fell over the room. On April 10, 1998, Clark summoned seven of the nation's most distinguished scientists and public health experts to make their case for biodefense directly to President Clinton. It was the culmination of the planning that Clinton spurred after his dinner with Venter. One of the first experts Venter had recruited for the advisory group was Josh Lederberg, who doubted that a meeting with the president would do any good. "Be careful when you dance with elephants," Lederberg had warned him. The other invited experts were Lucille Shapiro, a Stanford University microbiologist, Barbara H. Rosenberg, an authority on the Biological Weapons Treaty, Thomas P. Monath, a vaccine researcher and former head of the Army's Biodefense Lab, and Jerome M. Hauer, New York City's head of emergency management. The delegation was led by Frank Young, who had retired from his emergency preparedness post at HHS and become a pastor. Originally, the list of invitees had also included three other experts, among them Brad Roberts, a research staff member of the Institute for Defense Analysis. Roberts, a seasoned Washington military analyst, was rather more skeptical than some of the other invitees about whether states or terrorists would be able or willing to use germ weapons to kill masses of people anytime soon. He planned to highlight the inherent obstacles to the use of such germ agents and to put what he termed some balance into the debate about how serious a threat bioweapons posed and how much the United States ought to spend to counter it. But days before the meeting, a member of Clark's staff called him and two other invitees to say their invitations were being rescinded. There was so much cabinet-level interest in the experts' meeting that there was not enough room for all of the outsiders. Since Clinton had requested a small session, some experts had to be taken off the list. "They were very sorry," the official added. Maybe Roberts could attend a future meeting with the president. Besides this perceived bias, some observers felt that some of the participants had an inherent conflict of interest, since they were also involved in private enterprises that might bid for government contracts. Though the invitees differed on the likelihood of a germ attack in the near future, all agreed that the United States had dangerously neglected its public health system. An audience with Clinton, they felt, was the chance of a lifetime. No president had ever been more predisposed to understand their pleas. The scientists saw America's vulnerability to germ attack as an extreme example of the country's pervasive failure to deal with infectious diseases. Persuading Clinton to increase spending on public health would help millions of Americans, even if no one ever tried to attack America with germs. Compared with health care in other economically developed states, the U.S. public health system was a disaster. Almost half of all local health departments did not have the use of email. At least 1,000 of them had no access to any online or internet service. 20% of them still had rotary phones. Some local health departments could not even afford a microscope, much less sophisticated computer technology. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Epidemic Surveillance System, created a half century earlier to detect germ warfare attacks, was in tatters. Most epidemiological investigators and even emergency room physicians were unlikely to recognize a case of anthrax, a rare disease. Nor would they correctly diagnose a patient with smallpox, which had theoretically been eradicated. The meeting was scheduled for the Cabinet Room in the White House. President Clinton apologized in advance for seeming a little slow that morning. He had been up most of the night mediating between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republican Army to avoid the collapse of the peace process, and had gotten only an hour or two of sleep. Behind the experts was a ring of chairs occupied by Cabinet officials and their top aides, among them Defense Secretary Cohen, Attorney General Janet Reno, Health and Human Services Secretary Donna E. Shalala, Director of Central Intelligence George J. Tenet, National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, and Dick Clark. According to notes of the meeting provided by a participant and interviews with all the experts, Clinton told the group that he had become increasingly worried about the dangers of the new biological era. Because rogue states and terrorists could now manipulate genes, he said, offense may be getting ahead of defense. Nuclear weapons were expensive and relatively easy to detect, he said. Biological weapons were neither. Germs were a low-rent way to be a big player. Iraq's resistance to relinquishing its biological weapons program, for instance, showed that Saddam Hussein obviously placed a huge value on not giving it up. Iraq had forfeited tens of billions of dollars in oil revenues to retain its germ warfare agents and expertise. Later, Berg detailed the importance of scientific breakthroughs in the history of war, the dramatic results when offensive capabilities had outstripped defensive measures. The introduction of iron weapons, for instance, had made bronze weapons ineffective. Gunpowder had made the defensive armor of medieval knights obsolete. Horses and cavalries had enabled Asians to sweep through Europe. And now the offensive capability of germs as bioweapons seemed to be outstripping defenses against them. Germs, he said, were strategic weapons that could strike deep into the nation's heartland. Such attacks could be attempted by states, terrorist groups they supported, or lone actors. Individuals can make war with these new weapons, Lederberg warned. To counter such attacks, antiviral drugs and therapeutics were needed. So were new vaccines based on new technologies. Shapiro, a colleague of Lederberg's from Stanford, outlined the new possibilities offered by recombinant technology. To illustrate the awesome powers of new genetically manipulated germs, she described to the president how natural selection created new antibiotic-resistant microbes. What bugs do naturally, she said, was worrisome enough. Federal money was desperately needed to help science combat emerging new diseases, whatever their origin. Much of the government's support for research over the past 20 years had been spent on fighting heart disease and cancer. The NIH, she told Clinton and the others, had not been given sufficient resources to study pathogens and understand how they operated, or to do other basic antibiotic and antiviral research. Microbiology in general had been underfinanced. The bugs are smarter than we are, she declared, and the bugs are winning. Venter pushed hard for federal support for genetic sequencing and gene identification. The techniques were crucial, he argued, to detecting germs and designing drugs against new strains of ancient scourges, tuberculosis, among others. Scientists needed these genetic codes to protect the country. Recombinant technology was rapidly spreading for good and evil, he warned. Even high school students were now genetically engineering bacteria and viruses. Hauer, New York's emergency management director, outlined measures that the city had adopted to respond more effectively to a germ weapons attack. To detect sudden shifts in the health of its population, New York City now monitored not only daily admissions to hospital emergency rooms and the deaths of young or unlikely victims of mysterious ailments, but also less obvious public health indicators, such as sales of Kaopectate and other over-the-counter drugs used to treat diarrhea. He had also designated close to 300 facilities as pods, or points of distribution, for antibiotics and drugs in a crisis. He had selected Madison Square Garden and the Jacob K. Javits Convention Center for emergency care facilities where people could be treated if the city's hospitals were filled. New York had taught thousands of doctors, nurses, police, firemen, and other emergency personnel what to do and what not to do in responding to a chemical or germ attack. His department was planning to negotiate contingency agreements to buy drugs in huge quantities at affordable prices should the need arise. And yet, Hauer said, New York was still not prepared to respond to such an emergency. New York and other cities would desperately need federal assistance quickly to control unrest and to protect drugstores and hospitals that might be stormed as people sought antibiotics and vaccines for themselves and loved ones. And the federal government was still unable to provide timely help. Tom Manaff, a vaccine specialist who had joined a private vaccine company after a distinguished government career, stressed the need for new vaccines, antibiotics, and other antidotes to respond to infections from classical germs and genetically modified agents. He called Clinton's attention to a touchy issue, the limits on research spurred by an overly strict adherence to the Biological Weapons Treaty. Many scientists, he asserted, were reluctant to conduct important research because they feared that it could be seen as part of a biological weapons program and thus a violation of the treaty. Manaff said the government had underfunded vaccine research. The nation needed a vaccine for Ebola, for instance, but even the military said it could not afford to develop one. The private sector would not do this work because it was not profitable. Barbara Rosenberg, the group's specialist on the treaty banning biological weapons, told Clinton that he would have to place greater priority on negotiating a protocol to enforce the treaty if he wanted to stop the spread of germ weapons. American leadership was desperately needed if progress at the Geneva talks was to be made. The American pharmaceutical industry was opposed to demands for routine inspections of its plants, fearing industrial espionage and loss of trade secrets. However, the companies had accepted the idea of challenge inspections, spot checks that would be conducted if a country was charged with specific violations of the treaty. The drug makers' doubts could be assuaged by meaningful consultation with government officials, Rosenberg argued. Without such arrangements and adequate verification, she warned, the treaty was toothless. Clinton frequently interrupted the brief presentations, firing off questions to the experts and his cabinet. How long would it take for the nation to develop the technology needed to quickly identify and diagnose deadly pathogens? Who was doing such research and where? Was such work being coordinated by anyone in the government, in the private sector? If a terrorist let something loose inside an airport, how long would it take the government to figure out that the nation had been attacked, and how long after that to identify the agent? And finally, what about money? How much would an adequate defense cost? The cost would be high, the group agreed, adding that it would soon provide the president with specific proposals and cost estimates. On May 6th, Frank Young, the moderator of the experts group, sent the president a 17-page report summarizing its unanimous recommendations. The report, which was not made public, concluded that all levels of government were woefully unprepared for a bioweapons attack. It recommended focusing on two areas: the use of new genetic engineering techniques to develop better antibiotics and vaccines, and a plan for reducing civilian casualties if a dangerous pathogen was deliberately released. The document included a separate section suggesting ways in which the proposed protocol to the treaty banning germ weapons should be strengthened. Finally, it urged the president to establish an advisory committee to set priorities and foster cooperation among the many government fiefdoms with sway over biodefense and public health. The document Young submitted called for more than $1.9 billion in spending over the next 5 years, with a total of $420 million for national stockpiles of antibiotics and vaccines. This would be enough to provide 40 million doses of smallpox vaccine, which would reduce death and illness from a smallpox epidemic by 10 to 100-fold. The group called upon the government to invest $860 million in research to develop new antibiotics, antivirals, and vaccines, and to increase spending on the study and sequencing of genes, the molecular blueprints of microbes, and on diagnostic equipment to detect dangerous germs. Finally, the panel urged the president to spend $1.04 billion over 5 years to improve emergency responses to biological attack, with at least $170 million for the dilapidated public health system. One of the most politically delicate sections of the report had nothing to do with money. The document noted, for instance, that many of the experiments needed to study genetically manipulated organisms and to develop antibiotics and vaccines for them would not be permitted by recombinant DNA review board and biosafety regulations in the United States. If such research were to be done anyway and the results were published, the research might well raise alarm on the part of other nations, as did the Russian report on anthrax resistant to vaccine. It might also provide recipes, the group warned, to those interested in using genetic engineering for nefarious purposes. The experts endorsed such defensive research and urged that it be conducted under the guidance of an objective review board composed of civilian scientists and public health specialists. Such a panel could oversee Pentagon research and programs that would otherwise not be approvable under current regulations. The report did not address the issue of how this could be done without tipping off possible adversaries to America's vulnerabilities. Without directly saying so, the panel seemed to be arguing that the existing restrictions on genetic research should be sidestepped in the interest of national security. Dangerous new recombinant organisms had to be studied, made, tested, even if such work pushed to the limits of what the Germ Warfare Treaty allowed in the name of defense. The results of the presidential audience were somewhat less than the experts had hoped. A little more than 25% of the funds Young requested was initially approved for the first year. To be sure, Clinton's rhetoric changed measurably. In May 1998, the president traveled to the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis to present his plan for germ defense. "We must do more to protect our people," Clinton said. His speech touched all the bases. It urged the creation of a stockpile of vaccines and antibiotics for the first time in the nation's history. It said strengthening the treaty banning germ weapons was a major priority. It committed money to support basic research into deadly pathogens. It reflected Venter's influence by stressing the potential importance of decoding the human genome in designing new antibiotics. And it promised money to upgrade the nation's public health clinics to aid our preparedness against terrorism and to help us cope with infectious diseases that arise in nature. "We must not cede the cutting edge of biotechnology to those who would do us harm," the president told the cheering cadets. The president also signed a new executive order, Presidential Decision Directive 62, creating a White House office to coordinate the government's programs in security, infrastructure protection, and counterterrorism. The job of counterterrorism czar went to Dick Clark, greatly expanding his responsibilities. But the applause of the naval cadets had barely subsided when the resistance began, at home and abroad. Faced with unanticipated skepticism about the president's sweeping initiatives from both his own agencies and outsiders, the administration began trimming its pledges. In June, Clinton asked Congress for $294 million to finance all of the experts' proposals. While the group recommended spending $200 million to build a stockpile of vaccines and antibiotics, the White House initially requested $41 million. Less than a month later, the White House decided against spending any money at all to buy vaccines that year. More effective, cheaper vaccines might be available in 2 to 3 years, administration officials said. It was better to wait. In May 1998, 2 months after the military began vaccinating the troops in the Middle East, the go-ahead was given to proceed to the rest of the troops. The military began inoculating active duty troops around the world in August. Reservists were included in the initial round of vaccinations, but only if they spent more than 30 days in a high-threat area. Air National Guard pilots, who handle a significant number of the military's cargo flights into the Middle East while on weekend duty, were largely exempt from the shots since they only spend a few days in the region. By the summer of 1998, Pentagon officials were dealing with a new potentially controversial question: how to structure the command for the Guard and other military units that would respond to a chemical or biological attack within the United States. John J. Hamray told NATO officials in late June that the Pentagon was considering whether to appoint a new regional commander to direct homeland defense within America's borders. "We don't believe we have primary responsibility, but within minutes of an event, people are going to turn to us," Hamray said. "If there is a biological attack, you can easily see regional governors calling out the National Guard to quarantine the highways. It could get crazy very fast." Pentagon officials saw a host of valuable roles for the Guard or Reserve forces in the aftermath of a germ or chemical attack, from pitching tents to setting up field hospitals to burying the dead. The proposal alarmed civil liberties experts. A germ or chemical attack by terrorists would unleash chaos, and military units working with local authorities would be quickly pressed to maintain order, a mission for which they were not trained. Soon enough, soldiers would be arresting civilians. The United States has a long, proud history of restraining military operations on American soil. The Posse Comitatus Act, passed after the Civil War, bars federal troops from doing police work within U.S. borders. The New York Times editorialized against the plan for establishing a new command, saying it would erode the long-established legal principle that America's armed forces should not be involved in domestic law enforcement. Reacting to the criticism, the Pentagon scaled back the plan for Homeland Defense, reserving the command for a 2-star general drawn from the National Guard. Hamray felt the change would make a big difference. 4-star generals he had seen were a breed apart, treated like demigods by their subordinates and accustomed to giving orders that would be obeyed without question. A citizen soldier from the Guard would be much better equipped to understand America's civilian civil liberties culture. Critics were not mollified. Changing the rank of the commanding officer did not settle the question of how, precisely, the government would prevent the military from seizing control in the panicked hours after a terrorist assault. Popular fears about the issue were fanned by the movie The Siege, which came out in the fall of 1998. In the film, New York is attacked by a group of Arab terrorists, and a particularly obnoxious military officer, played by Bruce Willis, imposes martial law, rounds up American citizens, and puts them in barbed wire-fenced camps. Pentagon officials dismissed the movie as utter fantasy, but it had resonance. On January 22, 1999, President Clinton announced his decision to ask Congress for $2.8 billion to thwart and prepare for attacks with biological and other exotic weapons and to combat computer warfare threats. The money for fiscal year 2001, more than double what he had sought the year before, was part of an overall request of $10 billion to defend the nation against terrorism. With Josh Lederberg at his side, Clinton outlined the major elements of his expanded anti-terrorism program in a speech to the National Academy of Sciences, a decidedly friendly audience. Members of his cabinet, senior military and prominent civilian scientists, and scores of officials from emergency preparedness agencies applauded and cheered as the president defended the program to the 300-some people who had packed the Academy auditorium. The initiatives included $683 million to train emergency workers in American cities to cope with a chemical or biological attack, $206 million to protect government sites, and $381 million for research on dangerous pathogens, the development of new vaccines and therapies, technology to detect and diagnose rare illnesses, and decontamination. The White House also asked for $87 million, a 23% increase over the previous year's spending, to improve the nation's public health surveillance system, and $52 million to continue building a national stockpile of antibiotics and medicines against anthrax, smallpox, and pneumonic plague. Clinton also wanted to triple current spending to a total of $24 million to create 25 urban medical response teams in major American cities. Only 4 cities, Miami, Denver, Washington, and Charlotte, North Carolina, had been able to assemble and train such teams. While the bulk of the $10 billion request would be spent strengthening security at U.S. embassies and at other American facilities, public health officials were delighted. "For the first time in American history," said Donna Shalala, the Secretary for Health and Human Services, "the public health system was being integrated into national security planning." Lederberg, too, had gotten some of the money he wanted for basic research into dangerous pathogens. Lederberg's presence on the stage and the easy banter that day between the president and Josh sent a powerful signal to the federal bureaucracy. Lederberg and his fellow advocates of biodefense had influence at the White House that could no longer be ignored.